Keep going.
What was the next one?
Holly Wagner, Home Media Retailing.
Okay.
Debbie Charles Reuters. Kathleen Flaherty, Corporate Legal Time.
Rob Lever, AFP.
Wait. What is Corporate Legal Time?
Kathleen Flaherty.
Okay.
Rob Lever, AFP.
Okay.
Brooks Bowlick, The Hollywood Reporter.
Next.
Jeff Howe, Wired Magazine.
Okay, is that Jeff?
Yeah, huh?
Okay.
Aya Fruta from Nikkei.
What was that?
Aya, A-Y-A, Fruta, F-U-O-U-T-A, Nikkei.
I don't know how they're doing it. I mean, do people sign up?
We're calling attendance. That's how we're doing it. Next, anybody else we haven't spoken up?
Yes.
Wendy Davis, Media Post.
I was saying you San Francisco Chronicle.
Olivia DeGruver, Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press.
Tom Gagan, Boston Globe.
Del Geiser, Democracy Now.
Okay.
Brett Kendall, Los Angeles Daily Journal.
Okay.
Lisa Friedman, Los Angeles Daily News.
Who was that last one?
Lisa Friedman, Los Angeles Daily News.
Okay.
It's Robert Gehrke, the Salt Lake Tribune.
But how do you spell your last name?
G-E-H-R-K-E.
Okay.
Alexis, Daily Reporter Executive.
Okay.
Wyatt Andrews, CBS Evening News.
John Gordon, Minnesota Public Radio.
Okay.
Brian Watt, Marketplace Productions, recording for Kent Siglin.
Okay.
And it might be the problem.
Anybody else?
Yes.
Sarah.
3DFM.
Who's that?
Peter Schuler.
All right.
Thanks for holding. Over 500,000 readers, the Observer Automotive app daily.
Can we mute him?
Can we shoot him to play?
When you're looking for new wheels.
Hello?
Caggio tells the story.
There are more than 125 franchise auto dealers in the greater Charlotte area.
Somebody put it on hold.
Are everybody listening up? Nobody puts this call on hold. Got it?
Nobody puts baby in the corner.
And once we get started for the statements, everybody puts their things on mute.
How do we do that?
All right,
if you don't have mute, on your phone, hit *6. You will mute your phone, and when you want to speak, hit *6 again.
Star what to speak?
*6.
*6, mute and unmute.
Yeah. You can get my name. You want my name?
Yes, please.
Okay, it's Doug Schlatter, S-C-H-L-A-T-T-E-R from Lawcast.
Okay.
Tamara Terry from the News Hour with Kim Ware.
What was your last name?
Michelle, P-H-E-R-Y.
Okay.
Hi, Todd Shields with Media Week.
Randy Barrett, Tech Daily.
Okay.
Sarah McBride, Wall Street Journal.
Okay, anybody else?
Miguel Helms, San Jose Mercury News.
That's right, SAP.
Okay.
Liz Gaines, Red Herring.
Okay.
Stephanie Dew, Nightly Business Report.
Stephanie, what's the last name?
Dew, D-A-2-E.
Oh, right, I sent her stuff, right. Okay, is that everybody else?
Paul A., ABCnews.com.
Okay.
Greg Tapper, ABC News, World News Tonight.
What was the last name?
Tapper, T-A-P-P-E-R.
You used to work for 3M?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, next.
Michael Page for Grokster. Should I be on this line or a different one?
No, that's the line, Mike. I'm just taking attendance for the reporters.
Okay.
Okay, who else we got? Reporter?
Thomas Green for the Register.
Thomas what?
Green.
From? Which Register?
The.
Online website. Very cool place.
Okay. Neil Rollins. New Haven has registers too, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, who else we got?
Neil Rollins.
Chris Miller. The Importance of.
Okay, got you, Neil, too. Okay?
All right. Deborah McAdams, PG Technology Magazine.
All right.
Hey.
All righty. Anybody else?
Andy Shane from the...
World.
Andy who?
I'm sorry, Andy Shane, Herald Observer.
Okay.
John Mello, Tech World.
John, what was his last name?
M-E-L-L-O.
From?
Tech News World.
Okay. All right. Anybody else join so you can come in later? We're gonna have a group of speakers this morning, and I'll introduce them as they speak. All of them have been assigned various times to speak. They should know what those times are. I have Alex here with a timer, and we're not going to be afraid to use it. Our first speaker is going to be Richard Taranto. That's spelled T-A-R-A-N-T-O, from the firm of Farr, F-A-R-R, and Taranto. Mr. Taranto had the privilege of arguing the case before the Supreme Court. Mr. Taranto, are you with us?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I want to say just a few words about the two different aspects of how to think about this case, one of which is certainly more apparent than the other. One is what this means for the future of this particular litigation and how Grokster and Streamcast in particular will fare under the remand directive of the Supreme Court. The opinion is sufficiently multifactored and unclear about the precise inquiry that is supposed to be made and what evidence would satisfy that inquiry that it's, at least for me, premature to say what it will mean for Grokster and Streamcast in the future of this litigation, except to say that on first reading we think that we will have the evidence to dispel the inference that the entertainment companies have a right to try to prove that the Supreme Court said would be sufficient for liability. We said, as you may recall from the oral argument and from our brief in the case, that we were not in the Supreme Court in any way disputing the availability, legal availability, of a theory of inducing copyright infringement as a basis for liability. And what we said was that that issue remained in the district court for litigation, and that's where it will now go. The second and much more important, broadly speaking, aspect of what the court did today was to write a set of standards whose most notable immediate feature is their lack of clarity. And in particular, in talking about intent to promote infringement and knowledge of how products will be used for infringement or not, the court has now given as precedent to the whole world of digital technology companies a very difficult roadmap to follow. It has said to the Intels and others of the world, we have a multi-factor standard that you can't in advance be terribly sure how it will apply to you. And while the immediate impact of the decision for the future of our case is not clear, I think the immediate impact for the industry and technological innovation as a whole will be immediately seen to be a chilling one.
Mr. Taranto?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
You.
Gentlemen's time has expired, as they say in these parts. Our next speaker will be Fred von Lohmann. That's small V-O-N. Reporters, please mute by hitting star 6, and then you'll unmute to get later. Thank you. Fred von Lohmann, Fred, small V-O-N, capital L-O-H, M as in Mary, A-N-N, senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And with Fred is Cindy Cohn, C-O-H-N, the legal director. Fred?
Yes, good morning, everybody. I'd like to echo much of what Richard said. I think today's Supreme Court decision is going to unleash a new era of legal uncertainty on America's innovators. I think we are all confident that when we have the opportunity to present all the evidence in the district court, that the court will agree that Streamcast has not, in fact, induced or otherwise satisfied, otherwise violated the new test the Supreme Court has announced today. But the more important thing, I think, for this opinion is the fact that America's entire innovation sector is going to now face a new theory of copyright liability. The Supreme Court did not take the opportunity to clarify the Betamax test, nor did they take the opportunity to clarify vicarious liability. Instead, they essentially created a new theory of liability, one that I'm afraid will probably tie up courts for some time. The important question here for innovative companies is whether they will face a lawsuit on this new theory that could potentially cost them millions of dollars to defend. By focusing on intent, the Supreme Court really has opened the door to lawyers asking to see the notes of engineering meetings, the plans of marketing departments, the emails of technology company executives. That is a very expensive threat for most technology companies to face. I'm disappointed that the Supreme Court chose a road that created more uncertainty, but I am confident that Streamcast and Grokster will be able to rise to that challenge, and once all the evidence is put before the district court, prevail in the suit. That's all I've got.
Thanks, Fred. Our next is Michael Weiss. Michael, spelled the regular way, W-E-I-S-S, who is CEO of Streamcast.
Well, this is certainly another hurdle in the history of this company. But once all the evidence comes forward, we're confident that it will be proven that Morpheus does not promote or encourage copyright infringement. We voluntarily work closely with federal agencies such as FTC to go beyond the letter of the law. Now, we intend to continue our fight, and it's apparent that we'll have another day in court, make that several days in court, coming forward. So I suppose the David versus Goliath battle will continue, and we're staying in this for the fight. That's all I have now.
Thanks very much. Next we'll turn to G.G. Stone. That's G-I-G-I, middle initial B as in boy, S-O-H-N, who is president of Public Knowledge.
I think I'm going to take a little bit of a different tack from my colleagues who spoke further, although I do recognize some of their concerns. I've actually seen some positive things for technology companies and for consumers in this decision. And the first and most important is that the decision reaffirmed the core principle of the Sony Betamax case, that without more, a technology that is capable of substantial non-infringing uses is a legal one. And in fact, the court reaffirmed that peer-to-peer as a technology can be used for substantial non-infringing uses. What they focused on were affirmative acts, and we will see when the case goes back to the lower court whether, there is enough evidence here to prove that there is a copyright violation, but it's important to note that the court's Sony principle has been preserved. The other point that I would like to make is that to the extent that over the last couple weeks, last couple months, there's been a lot of sturm und drang about whether Congress has to act, has to pass some sort of legislation making sure that Hollywood's rights are protected, I would say there's absolutely no need for Congress to act. Sony Betamax principle has been upheld. The case has been sent back to the lower court for fact-finding. A new inducement standard. There's nothing that Hollywood should want or need here from Congress. I'm not saying they won the case. I think there are reasons for technology companies and consumers to be at least somewhat optimistic about this decision. To the extent that Hollywood wants to run to Congress and change the Sony doctrine, we will oppose that strongly.
Thank you, Gigi. Gary Shapiro, the president and CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association, was supposed to have been our next speaker today. Unfortunately, his mother passed away over the weekend, and we do send him our sympathies. Stepping in ably for him this morning is Michael Petricone, P as in Paul, E-T-R-I-C-O-N-E, who is Vice President of Technology Policy for the Consumer Electronics Association. Michael?
Thank you. We're still digesting the opinion. You know, we're obviously quite concerned that a new liability theory based on inducement will freeze the introduction of new technologies in the marketplace. I think it's a very real concern for the entire industry. I think we're quite conscious that we now exist as a technology industry in an increasingly competitive world. We are faced with competitors in China, in India, who do not face the same kind of litigation burden that companies do in the United States. But I think it's fair to say with this decision, the legal clarity has decreased, and the risk of litigation has increased. And from a competitive standpoint, that is just not a good thing, obviously. I think there is a resemblance here with the Induce Act legislation that was introduced in the last Congress, and that legislation was widely criticized by the technology industry and by consumer groups. I think businesses need clarity, and this decision makes the legal landscape less clear. And certainly, we're going to continue to work with everybody and continue to work with policymakers to ensure a pro-technology, pro-innovation environment.
Thank you very much, Michael. Somebody is in the middle of an emergency. Our next speaker is Michael Page. He is in Paul, A-G-E, a partner in the law firm of Kecker, K-E-K-E-R, and Van Ness, as in the bird, from San Francisco, who represented Grokster. Mike?
Hi. I think there's some good things and some bad things here. Obviously, the court's decision to uphold the Sony doctrine unchanged and not go down the road of, parsing the numbers more tightly is a good thing. I'm disappointed that the court simply decided not to address vicarious liability at all, so that leaves us with knowing no more than we did last week. The biggest problem is that the court seems to have, on the one hand, recognized that active inducement, as it's always been understood, is part of contributory infringement. You go and actively encourage someone to infringe. That's one thing. But then the court's discussion of what it means to induce leaves us with a whole bunch of conflicting signals and standards. At one point, the court seems to say that if you sell a product that replaces a prior peer-to-peer software, and you know that the prior peer-to-peer software was used largely for infringement, you're actively inducing. That seems an absurd result. That means that if your software is predominantly infringing and you're the first one, you're protected under the Sony doctrine. But then the next person comes along with a similar software, they end up inducing simply by having knowledge that someone else's software was primarily used for infringing purposes. The conflicting signals on what inducement means is, as Fred said, going to lead to a whole lot of litigation and a whole lot of trials that cannot be resolved on summary judgment. But I think the vagueness of the court's discussion of what inducement is going to cause problems down the road. But for Grokster, I think we'll be able to show clearly that we did nothing to actively induce.
Thank you, Mr. Page. Our next speaker is Ed Black, B-L-A-C-K, the president of the Computer and Communications Industry Association. Ed?
A couple quick things. First of all, we agree that we need more time to really read it all over. But it's very clear at the same time that this is a very dangerous decision for technology and for innovation. It's probably a big victory for lawyers. The standard was in essence upheld, which is positive, but if you think of the Sony decision as somewhat of a shield and an umbrella for technology innovation, we're afraid that some holes have been punctured in that umbrella. We now have a blurry standard, and that's going to require litigation to clarify. At the same time, I think it is important to say that to the large extent Hollywood really has achieved some of what it wanted here, and we also believe that it is now time for Hollywood to turn its attention to new business models to take advantage of this technology and stop their seeking, frankly, rather overreaching and unnecessary legislation in that process. We have seen a greater trend towards regulatory encroachment and greater regulation of the flow of information on the Internet. This is an unhealthy trend for everyone who cares about Internet, digital information, and transition. At the same time, this decision does uphold the fundamental concept of Betamax. We'll have to see, frankly, how it plays out over time.
Thank you very much, Ed. Our next speaker is Charles Baker, a partner in the law firm of Porter and Hedges, H-E-D-G-E-S, from Houston, representing Screencast. Mr. Baker.
Thank you. Yes, I'm going to just be brief because a lot of what I intend to say has already been said. But, you know, I've been representing, along with Fred, Screencast sometime. And from the day from the district court opinions, the Ninth Circuit, now the Supreme Court, we will be back before the district court. And we're looking forward to litigating this issue because there's a substantial amount of evidence that has not been brought forward that we intend to bring forward this next go-around that we will show, or we believe very strongly will show, that even under this new standard, Screencast will not be held liable. I also echo the same thoughts that this is a confusing standard. And being a litigator like Mike Page, I can see this leading to a lot more litigation in this area and very expensive litigation against companies that cannot and may not be able to have the wherewithal to fight this, because it's going to be a fact-intensive standard now on what it means to actively induce someone. I mean, if you look at the opinion, it should almost be stressed as one more even think about it, think about inducing, and a product think about inducing that that person or that company could be liable. So this is not going to slow down. If not, it's going to intensify litigation. And again, like others, I believe it's going to hamper the technology industry moving forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Baker. And to wrap up this portion of the program is Matthew Necco, NECO, General Counsel of Screencast. Mr. Necco?
Thank you. Thank you very much. This decision seems somewhat overwhelming to me in that it seems that the copyright and entertainment industry has now become the Fox police. The guy in the garage, the gal in the executive suite, had better be very sophisticated about what they think, let alone what they communicate with each other, let alone what they communicate with their potential customers, because their every thought and their every action will now be subject to discovery in expensive litigation. It seems to me that this will be a full lawyer employment outcome, because when there's this great a degree of uncertainty, lawyers are going to get pulled into every aspect of innovation and business and will need to get consulted. It's not a great way for a business to have to function. And in the end, the attorney-client privilege is going to have to be well tested here. And with all of this uncertainty, I think that innovation suffers and the American consuming public will suffer as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate that. Since we took roll at the beginning of this, have others who have not called out the names of the reporters joined us?
This is Lorraine Willard at Business Week.
Others?
Karen Joyce, Internet News.
Larry Abramson at NPR.
Jim Bensavenga with the Christian Science Monitor.
This is Peter Cook at Bloomberg Television.
Eric Hesselwell at Forbes.
Scott Morrison, Financial Times.
What was the first name, John?
Scott.
Okay, anybody else? Okay, before we get started with Q's and A's, let me make one little housekeeping announcement. First of all, as you may guess, we have a large group of speakers this morning, and there are others around who can also provide good resources for you. And a couple, three of those are Adam Eichgrau, the Executive Director of TCP United, Marty Lafferty, the CEO of the Distributed Computing Industry Association, and Matthew Brown from the law firm of Cooley Godward in San Francisco, which represented emerging technology companies on the briefs in the case. With that, we're going to take questions. Mr. Healy, would you like to lead off?
Sure. I haven't been able to make my way through the decision yet, but one thing we've got in the summary, which granted isn't controlling, but could somebody talk about whether, in fact, by focusing on time shifting as the principal use of VCR, the justices here may be saying that that is, in fact, something that folks need to pay attention to, principal use as opposed to simple capability.
Fred, you want to do that one?
Yeah, this is Fred. This is Fred von Lohmann. John, I think you'll find when you read the opinion that the Supreme Court very specifically ducks that question. In the unanimous opinion of the court mentions that question, whether or not the proportion of infringing or non-infringing uses is relevant, and specifically says they are not going to, in this case, take a position on that, because this ruling is based on this inducement theory. The concurrences actually do talk more extensively about that, with Justice Breyer's concurrence in particular emphasizing that proportion, to the extent it's relevant, you know, even a 10% in non-infringing use amount would be enough to support the Betamax defense. I believe Justice Ginsburg's concurrence takes much the opposite view. So we're really left without any new clarity on that question, I'm afraid. We have, the unanimous court taking no view. We have three justices on one side saying one thing, and I think, two in Ginsburg's concurrence saying another? Three, sorry. So, yeah, so I'm afraid we don't know anything definite about that question, John.
Thanks. Ted? Brightus? Are you there?
I'm here.
If you're unmuting, unmute. Okay.
Sorry, I was unmuted.
Okay. Have you a question?
No, I'm just listening quietly.
Okay. Good man. Okay, others? Go ahead. Mr. Borland?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I guess this question for CEA as much as anybody. Do you expect to immediately go to Congress to try to either clarify this or find a different standard?
We're still digesting the opinion and we're considering our options. I gotta reemphasize that we're quite concerned about the potential for litigation against legitimate technology.
How about the rest of you? Do you see that this requires a congressional response?
Ed, do you want to talk on that?
Well, as I said, I think that Hollywood's need for going forward, I think, is now really obviated by the decision. I think it will be a question as to whether or not further clarification in the courts or legislation is the best course to go from some of our standpoint.
Just as Gigi said, I would agree with that. I think we need to see what the court says, the lower court says. And, there's always a danger when you start a legislative process that it will be hijacked by Hollywood and turned into something we really, really, really don't like.
All right, thanks.
Okay, next question. Mr. Andrews, did you have a question? Star 6. Are you there? Mr. Andrews, going once. Going twice. All righty. Mr. Ehrenstein. All righty. In that case, whoever has a question, shout them out.
Hi there. Chuck Daly. Quick question here is that the court seems to have looked at the behavior of Grokster and essentially bought all the arguments of the content industry. What's your response, perhaps to the Grokster lawyer?
Mr. Page.
Yeah, hi. They certainly have. I mean, the briefing was a lot of very vague, these guys did terrible things with no facts to back it up. And the court does seem to have bought into it. Now, there's some justification in that given that they were ruling on our summary judgment motion. So, essentially, all the court's saying is there's enough smoke here for the court to go see if there's some fire. I'm confident
that when we get back there, the court will see that there really isn't any fire. Grokster really did nothing to induce or encourage any infringement, and did nothing but distribute a tool that had substantial non-infringing uses, which this court has now affirmed does not give rise to liability.
Okay, thanks.
I have a question.
Who is this?
This is Tom Wiley from Bloomberg.
Okay.
How is this going to change the activities of both sides in the short term before you get back down to the trial level?
Mr. Weiss, do you want to talk to me from the business way or the legal end?
Business end.
Michael Weiss, do you want to talk to that?
Sure. For the business end at Marcus, you know, we do make available authorized content from the content providers, and actually our new Morpheus 5.0 has been built from the ground up just to do that. So, you know, business as usual. We don't induce infringement at all. As a matter of fact, we go so far in the way of trying to be sure that the users out there know about the infringing uses that they should not do. I mean, we work very closely with the FTC. They came out with a report just late last week that verifies that. So we're just going to continue to innovate, come out with new products that does continue our non-infringing uses, substantial non-infringing uses, and more so.
Let me answer that from a broader industry perspective. I think the biggest concern will be that
Who is this?
Ed Black. Is that basically a lot of companies are going to have an overhead of legal costs that they've not had, and for smaller companies that could be very burdensome. The fear of litigation, the threat of litigation is substantial. I think it will be interesting whether the content industries in fact quickly initiate lawsuits, and that is one of the things we will watch in the short run, whether or not they in fact go very aggressively and bring suits against those with very little inducement issue, but enough that if Hollywood does not like a certain product, then this maybe gives them a lever to now require a broadcast flag or other things like that Hollywood would like.
This is Art.
Yes.
Paul Swidding.
Hi, Paul.
Hi. For Fred or anyone, where do you suspect this decision, this ruling, leaves existing products and the manner in which they're marketed, like TiVo or iPod? I mean, are those companies going to have to look at how they're marketing their product now?
Michael?
I'm sorry.
Metricone?
Yeah, you know, again, I think the one thing you know if you're TiVo or iPod or even a more concern to me, the next guy in the garage coming up with the next great product, that the legal environment you're facing is much less clear. And reading the Supreme Court decision, as an innovator, I'm not sure you know what the rule is, and I'm not sure what you know what you have to do in order to avoid being sued. And that's that. Again, from the innovation industry, that is the real concern here. It's the law is unclear, and innovators are really really in jeopardy because you don't know what the rule is.
This is Cindy Cohen at EFF. I have to echo that a bit. I think that there's nothing about the Supreme Court decision that would exclude a claim against somebody, say, advertising mix burn or, downloads faster type of, as a basis for initiating a lawsuit. And then, of course, it's just open season on anything that you've ever said internally or externally about possible uses of the product. So I guess I wouldn't say that this should give anybody in those positions much comfort. It's a murky multi-factor standard, and there's nothing about it that on its face would exclude such litigation.
And this is Michael. I'm going to add one more thing. The key is that you get sued under this standard. Odds are you're not going to be able to get off on summary judgment, and there will be very expensive litigation, and that litigation will involve massive discovery and looking at internal statements and internal emails and internal governing documents, trying to figure out what the intent was. And that's
a concern. And this is Matthew Necco. Let me also add to that it won't just be a question of looking at internal documents and statements. It will also involve, I believe, extensive depositions of inventors, innovators, marketing people, just into what they were thinking, let alone what it is that they may have communicated.
This is Paul Kirby with
Paul, before you do that, the speaker just before that was Cindy Cohn, spelled C-O-H-N, who is the legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
And before her?
That was Michael Petricone from CEA.
Thank you.
As you all know, some of the telephone companies, internet service providers filed a friend of the court brief. They were concerned about their liability under the case. If anyone wanted to speak to today's decision and the impact, sort of that secondary impact on those companies and trade groups.
Anybody on the call first?
It's Ed Black again. Clearly, they have an interest that's somewhat different than companies who do a lot of creation and technology that we focus on, but they have a huge interest at stake. And the same problems that we've been hitting on, which is it raises their uncertainty risk, it makes it harder for them to negotiate with content in Hollywood, they have to do all the time.
Right.
If they're basically vulnerable to suit. And we talked about all the discovery issues. It's not that that will take place in all cases. It's the fact that the threat of that actually taking place gives a huge club to people to extract concessions.
Okay.
I'd like to call also on Mike Godwin, G-O-D-W-I-N, who is the legal director of Public Knowledge.
Yeah, I think the telecom companies and all the and broadband providers, anybody who's interested in providing broadband is going to look at this case and they're going to ask themselves, will the content companies come after me and say, you're providing broadband, you know that some high percentage of the people who are using your broadband services are downloading copyrighted works. There's some discussion in the majority opinion about what can be inferred from the lack of imposing filters for copyrighted works or for the lack of, you know, what can be inferred from not taking steps. I think that the broadband companies also feel that they may be in the crosshairs here, and I think you'll hear that from them if you ask them.
Right. Okay.
Questions?
David Lawrence with the David Lawrence Show. Do you think, as almost everybody speaking here is an attorney, and I don't know how much you can speak to this, but do you think that some of the arguments that have been made in the past about your services being designed specifically so that you cannot tell what people are doing with your services might change from an operations perspective now that this has been handed down?
Mr. Baker, you want to address that one?
Sure, and then let me just make sure I'm clear on the question. Are you saying that fact or those evidence, you think that the companies will have to change the way they're doing business?
Well, I'm asking if, in fact, that's what you might be contemplating now that this has been offered up.
Well, I mean, as Michael White said, I mean, the Streamcast in particular has always, since I've been involved with the litigation, and we're talking about many, many years going back, we have been doing what we're continuing to do today, which is to absolutely minimize any type of risk for and also make the users well aware that what they do could possibly cause them to have some issues. So, but I don't see us. As Mike said, I don't see us having changed in the way we do business because we've been very confident from day one that what we have been doing more recent several years is legitimate and is allowed under the law.
Mr. Page, do you want to chip in?
I mean, I would agree that, on that. We don't really do anything other than provide software. Grokster doesn't do anything other than ship a product that this opinion says is legal. That there's nothing to change. We don't advertise. We don't communicate with users. We don't proselytize. To the extent we proselytize, it's for independent artists that have authorized the sharing of their work and welcome Grokster. So there's nothing to change.
This is Lorraine Willard of Business Week. You don't advertise or communicate with users, but you do communicate with potential advertisers, right? So that there is external communication.
I'm not sure what you mean. I mean,
well, the court, I mean, one of the things the court is looking at is, you know, and then this is the Motion Picture Association's, RIA's line, I grant it, but what they're looking at is your behavior probably more than the technology. And, in fact, there is external communication to, for example, people who you want to sell advertising space to.
I think what the court's reference to advertising was a bit bizarre. I mean, essentially what it's saying is, what it seemed to be saying is, look, you know, the amount of money you make because you're an advertising-supported business it varies based on your usage, and a lot of your usage is infringing, and therefore you make more money, which seems to be directly contrary to the core holding, which is that, you know, you can't look at the proportion of infringing or non-infringing use to decide legality. So I'm puzzled by that. But I think that's the only thing they were saying about advertising. They were saying that there was something in the communications with advertisers.
Well, the idea, one of the pitches being that all the Napster users will come to us.
Oh, okay. Actually, I don't
know. So, yeah.
Client, but
yeah, yeah.
So what? I mean, yes, a lot of people thought Napster that the user base of Napster was an important new market. You'll notice that Napster was bought out of bankruptcy by a company funded by the entertainment industry and is now out there with the brand name Napster on an entertainment industry sponsored site. Of course they want to sell to that market. Everyone does. I don't see anything illegal about that. And I'm very troubled by the idea that the court thinks that you can infer bad intent from someone going, there's a large market out there for both legitimate users, and we'd like to target them, notwithstanding the fact that people also use those tools for illegitimate purposes. It's a very dangerous sort of aside in the opinion.
Can I ask one quick follow-up, though, and to the group as a whole, whoever wants to answer? The point I'm trying to get at is that is it really the technology that we need to be worried about here, or is it, in fact, just the business model and the behavior of companies that's being targeted?
Ben, you want to take that one?
Well, it's Ed Black. Let me take a quick stab. Again, you're assuming like this bad conduct and good conduct. The trouble when you're in a potential litigation situation, there's all kinds of ambiguous conduct, which in fact may truly be innocent, but can be interpreted in a litigation context adversely. That's why the chill, that's why the broad negative impact on technology in general. It's not that we're really worried about bad conduct being caught. That's fine. It's that a whole lot of very benign, ambiguous conduct is now subject to challenge with all that heavy burden that is entailed with that.
I think the decision was about behavior and business models and not about technology. The peer-to-peer is going to live on in whatever form. I think the court was pretty clear, the court was pretty clear in saying that, you know, this is not about technological design. But I think the clearer point is that even if all the people on this phone call went away tomorrow, okay, the Grokster's, the Streamcast of the world, they're still going to be peer-to-peer. And Hollywood and the recording industry are still going to have to deal with it. And they're going to have to try to modify their business model to take advantage of it as opposed to killing it. So, you know, I think this is a pyrrhic victory for them at best.
This is Mike Weiss over Streamcast. I just want to add that Streamcast Marcus has no intentions of going away today, tomorrow, or the next day.
Other questions?
Can you hear me?
Yes, who is this?
It's Brooks.
Hey, Brooks.
Yeah, okay. You guys are saying that this decision is going to have a chilling effect on technology and on innovation. But just a couple of minutes ago, we heard Mike Weiss say that, you know, it's not going to change anything he's doing, and it's not going to stop him to innovate. So, what is it?
Difference of opinion, obviously.
Mike's in the middle of specific litigation. We're talking about a broad impact on a lot of different kinds of companies.
Is that you, Ed?
So, somebody's going to, you know, you're in very competitive businesses. I don't see the next iPod person stopping because he's going to want to get those socks.
Fred, you want to speak to that? This is Fred Baumann, and let me respond briefly to that. In the wake of this opinion, Apple, in my opinion, is not going to do a big burn as an ad campaign for their iPod. That's a very concrete example of the kind of chill that this opinion will impose. It'll make a broad array of technology companies have to second-guess their marketing plans, second-guess, you know, what's in their emails between their engineers, and potentially allow a lot of lawyers to make a lot of fees by even sending a threat of litigation. It's a lot like securities class action work.
Brooks, this is Mike Weiss again. You know, I think what this is going to do is scare the bejesus out of a lot of small developers. I think it's going to have a very chilling effect for a lot of people. I mean, we're in the middle of this thing. We're fighting this, and we're not going to give up. It doesn't mean that others will be afraid to even begin the battle, afraid to even come out of the garage. And that is a problem. And I think what today's ruling did is really potentially giving an unfair competitive advantage to overseas developers and overseas technology companies, and that's sad.
This is Anthony from Billboard. It's been pretty clear that, that, at least from a recording industry standpoint, that there is a lot of interest in using digital channels as a way of distributing music, and they may be having some problems with a lot of the P2P networks that are out there, but they're certainly embracing the overall digital standpoint. So don't you think there's really still a lot of room for folks that are creating digital-related distribution technologies to really play a role and work with the record companies to make that a viable channel?
Well, they're not embracing peer-to-peer. I mean, they won't license to the peer-to-peer companies.
They've licensed to some peer-to-peer companies.
What's that?
They've licensed to some peer-to-peer companies, right, like World Impact, the Peer Impact service from World Media.
Right, and I'd like to ask you, how many users do those people have? I mean, you know, the peer-to-peer companies that have tens of millions of users, they're not licensing to them. That doesn't make very much sense from a business standpoint, not to license your work to those companies that have by far the greater number of customers.
And I think then the key point to follow up there is and it's just that it's negotiating,
Ed, this is Art. I think you've had a number of answers here. Let's let some of the other people chip in.
This is Mark Weiss over Streetcast. We will, we do work with legitimate content providers and distributors. Hopefully we'll be able to work with more of them. As a matter of fact, we will shortly be announcing the availability of over a million pieces of digital content available for sale through Morpheus with the authorization of the content providers and copyright holders.
Next question, please.
Art, Bill Triplett from Variety. Obviously, we've got a lot of what people are talking about, ambiguity and just a lack of clarity on this decision. But what we do know also, obviously, is that it's going back for trial. And it's going back to trial on what, again, what people have been saying is very unclear, ambiguous standard. Whatever gets decided in that court, in the district court, I mean, aren't we ultimately talking about another round of appeals that very likely might bring this back on a dispute over what the inducement standard is that may come right back to the Supreme Court?
Matthew Necco, you want to talk to that one?
Yes, certainly. I do believe that is correct. I do think that one will need to determine whether the amount of thought or communication rises to the standard of being such that it is inducing under what the Supreme Court has said. So I agree that there will be continuing litigation over this and an attempt to further define what the standard is.
Fred, Michael, either of you two want to chip in?
Yes, Mike. I mean, clearly we are going to be left with some wide open questions as to, you know, what different pieces of ambiguous evidence mean. You know, when somebody sends an email to tech support saying, I'm having trouble getting a file I already own to play, and gets back a canned response about you know, what codecs you need to play various types of files, does the fact that buried in that email was the name of a title mean that the person who sent that canned response from tech support is actively inducing infringement? I don't think the district court or a jury can find anything in this opinion that tells them the answer to that question. And it's really just a free-for-all. What this opinion has done is taken a whole lot of things that the court has previously said do not give rise to liability, knowing that the majority of your users infringe, having the theoretical ability to redesign your product to give you control you don't have. These are all things that this court says do not give rise to liability, but then turns around and lists as the kind of things that would prove intent and give rise to liability. Given that, God only knows what a jury or a court is going to do. And it's just going to guess, and then it may wind its way back up to the court to try again.
Yes, I have to echo what Mike says and say that, you know, one of the
Cindy?
Things that's unfortunate about
this. Oh, who's speaking? Cindy,
sorry, this is Cindy Cohen at EFF. I think that one of the things that's most important about this decision was that we went to the Supreme Court hoping to get clarity and about a bright line rule that innovators can live with and that copyright infringers could live with. And instead we got sent back a murky multi-factor test that really is going to result in more litigation for years to come, not only for Streamcast, which will go back down now to the court, but I think for a large number of other companies. We've been talking a little bit about the fact that Hollywood would sue or the content owners would sue, but it's important to remember that secondary copyright liability can be claimed by anybody. It can be just one author. It can be just one person who can bring this kind of litigation, and I think we're going to see plaintiff's lawyers getting extremely active in this area and see a lot more litigation to come. So I think it's unfortunate that we hoped for clarity and did not receive it.
Mike Godwin from Public Knowledge.
Yeah, I just want to echo a little bit of what Cindy said. I think that as I was reading through the decision, I would read passages where they said, well, this alone isn't going to be something that you can infer inducement from, and then you look at their summary of their understanding of the facts in the record below, and they list some of the same factors sort of taken collectively. It's very hard to look at that and say, well, there's some kind of collective facts and circumstances test. It's very hard for you to anticipate how to design your business or design your next product without knowing, without having anything firmer than what the court has given us today.
Thanks, Mike. Next question.
This is Lorraine again at Business Week. Have we sort of dodged a bullet in terms of the, there was all this concern that the content people would be able to, quote unquote, dictate. Changes in technology to protect content and get involved in the engineering process, et cetera. Have we dodged that bullet? I mean, the fact that the business model is really what's being looked at here, protect us from that?
Can I respond to that? This is Mike Godwin from Public Knowledge. I think the way to read the court's discussion of business models is to say, not that you're looking at business models and that's sort of the dispositive factor. You're looking at business model, it might be evidence of intentional, active inducement.
Okay.
I think that, as far as dodging a bullet goes, to the extent that technology companies are going to be self-policing to avoid litigation, Hollywood may have gotten what it wants even without sort of dictating in any direct way what the technology design was. It's important to remember here that companies as they march through a product through development, they think through how the product has to look, and then they have to pass it by the legal department, and now it's a lot harder to get through that second step.
Others of our panel wish to answer?
This is Fred von Lumen. I think we did not dodge that bullet. The Supreme Court today focused on a lot of different factors that they claim were relevant to intent. The business model question is only one of them. So I think there is a very real risk in the wake of this opinion that the notes from your engineering meeting, the emails between your executives, all of that material may be relevant once there is any overt act of inducement alleged. So I think this could actually unleash a lot of new litigation that imposes a lot of costs on innovation business.
In other words, and I guess the court did, Fred, the court did mention the lack of filtering, for example.
Yeah, this is my take. I found that to be probably the most troubling thing in the entire opinion. The court at one point says, no, of course you don't have an obligation to redesign your product to prevent infringement, and that wouldn't give rise to liability. But then turns right around and says that the decision not to redesign your product to deter infringement can be evidence of an intent to induce infringement. That I think is the most troubling thing in the entire opinion. By first saying we're not even going to look at vicarious liability and decide what the proper scope of vicarious liability is in terms of who can be vicariously liable, and then saying we can infer that you intended infringement by the fact that you didn't design a filtering system to police someone else's copyrights, is the scariest part of the entire opinion.
Next question, please.
Hi, Todd Shields with Media Week. We've been, I don't know if dancing around this is the right word, but flat out, can the studios put Grokster out of business if they succeed in the lower court level and prove that you all were inducing infringement?
Mr. Page?
That's sort of a tautology. Can they win if they win? Yeah, of course. The question is whether they can show that Grokster intentionally induced infringement.
The opinion is very opaque on what the remedy is. There are hints in different directions. Do you get an injunction that says stop inducing, or do you get an injunction that says you may not sell this product? There's virtually no guidance in the opinion for a lower court as to where you go. Suppose at the end of the day at trial, the industry proves that Grosser once sent one email to someone who said, how do I download a Madonna song? And Grosser said, here's how you do it. Is the remedy that no one can ever use Grosser? Or is the remedy that Grosser's liable for that infringing copy? Or somewhere between? We have no more guidance now than we did yesterday.
This is Fred von Lohman. I want to echo that. I just think it's important to point out that today, Streamcast is not, clearly not, inducing or encouraging any copyright infringement of any kind. There is no tech support encouraging it. There is no advertising. There is nothing of the kind that the Supreme Court talked about in the opinion. All of that was evidence from years ago. So the question really becomes, what's the remedy here? If the remedy is stop inducing, that any hint of inducement ceased long ago. If the remedy is your technology is taken off the market, then every technology company has to worry that a misstep years ago will pull their current product line off the market today.
We've reached the 1 o'clock hour. Are there further questions for the panel? Going once? Going twice?
Hey, Art, can I ask a quick one? It's Mike Grab Acquired News.
Right under the wire, Mr. Grab.
Yeah, this is, I know this isn't, I just wanted to see if anyone, because some other people on the call might be covering Brand X today. Does anyone have anything to say about Brand X?
Yes, I do.
T.C. Stone.
I think today's decision points out the need for Congress to adopt and codify a net neutrality principle when it rewrites the telecommunications laws. Because if you're going to say that Earthlink and other ISPs can't interconnect to broadband systems, then at the very least, and in fact in addition to, you need to have an enforceable principle that says that no content or applications over broadband systems can be discriminated against by the broadband provider. This heightens the need for an enforceable, codified net neutrality principle.
Others want to chip in on Brand X?
On Brand X, this is Lorraine again. On Brand X, I mean, is Brand X and Grokster, is there a way to bring these together? I mean, are those sort of the victories for the entrenched interests or no? Oh,
that would be a good start.
I
mean, they are both about the future of the Internet.
Actually, let me interject there. Said Black, the CCIA. There is a similarity in that the significant players now have the ability to dictate the terms of digital distribution. I think that focusing mainly on Grokster, but it actually can be applied across the board. And that's, when you talk about business models, it is the ability to dictate the terms of digital distribution, the terms of content on the Internet, is what now content people theoretically have gotten leverage to be able to dictate to others.
Further questions? If not, I'd like to thank Brian O'Neill again from Streamcast and Annalee Newitz from EFF for helping him put this together. Brian for his phone line. An audio file will be available at EFF later. If you have questions, I'm sure any of the panelists would be pleased and proud to follow up. Thanks very much, and on to your next press conference.